Buenas noches, señores y señores.
I am Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto.
And I'm here tonight because I am in support of the current immigration legislation which is before your Congress, because I too wish to immigrate to America someday
and take the job of your president.
Now, of course, the White House would be known as the Casablanca. But as to be expected, I would do twice the work for half the pay. Now, the downside would be that 18 of my cousins would be living in the Oval Office. But the upside is the Rose Garden would look immaculate. Now, one of the provisions of this new legislation is that we must seal off the Mexican and U.S. border by building a 12-foot wall. Now, I have no problem with this, as I recently purchased a factory that manufactures and sells 13-foot ladders. Win-win. Now, I am a dashing man, no? Huh? But I am not as dashing as your U.S. Senator, Marco Rubio, yeah. He is also a friend of the immigration legislation. As a matter of fact, he is on a committee known as the Gang of Eight. Now, this is not a Mexican gang, no. This is far more dangerous. This is a gang of U.S. politicians. But Marco Rubio, well, he is their muy caliente comandante.
I'm in a sweet position with fat cats and gallipoles. I've got a premonition. I'm gonna score a goal.
Look at his legislation. He's got a clever plan. A telemundo station is gonna pass his span.
We'll make a path to citizenship. I will take a stand.
We've had a path we've used for years for coming to this land. It's called the Rio Grande. Oh, yeah.
Upside, inside out, living la vida, Marco. There can't be no doubt, we're taking the lead of Marco. Soon the world will shout, and I have a certain sparkle. We'll push this bill out. Obama won't veto Marco.
Oh, yeah.
Living la vida, Marco. Living la vida, Marco.
Ah, very good. Oh, look. Look who it is. It is my nephew, Juan. Hi, Juan. How are you doing? Now, he is here tonight because he loves Marco Rubio. This is his hero. And Juan would like to stay in this country and do everything that Americans do, like drive your Toyotas. And you better hope that Juan stays here too, because otherwise you're going to be paying $500 for a salad. Juan!
We are in a thicket, because we like our food real cheap.
Juan, if he doesn't pick it, a grape will cost more than a Jeep.
Give us your masses of huddled and poor who yearn.
I can breathe free, which is good, given what I'll earn.
One thing that we agree on, if we build a border fence,
bills in U.S. will cost a ton. Son,
since we face a big expense here, who will have to build the fence here? Guys like Juan.
That's me.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can hear this program at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area, or you can go to axissacramento.org, or you can download it from greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. And we're on Facebook. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Does Income Inequality Impair the American Dream?
Now we move on to round two in our debate. Round two is where the debaters address one another directly, and they take questions from me and from you in the audience. A reminder of where we are, we have two teams of two arguing for and against this motion, income inequality impairs the American dream of upward mobility. We have heard the team arguing for the motion, Elise Gould and Nick Hanauer, say, you know, some inequality is built into the system and some inequality is even a spur to innovation, but a point comes where it becomes too much and it can actually kill the American dream. They say, basically, using the image of a ladder, that if the rungs are spread farther apart than they ever have been before, and the top is higher than it's ever been before, that intuitively it becomes much more difficult to climb, that the distance from the bottom to the top has become staggering. The team arguing against the motion, Scott Winship and Ed Conard, also acknowledge that there is a lot of income inequality, but they say that is not the cause of a loss in upward mobility in the United States. They cite a number of studies that have looked at this and have crunched the numbers comparing income inequality with mobility, and they find that there is no meaningful relationship, and that the downward pressure on wages in the United States, which they acknowledge is real, has other causes. So I found it interesting that Scott Winship, who is arguing against the motion, said that the motion as phrased, income inequality impairs the American dream of upward mobility, sounds intuitively correct, but is factually wrong. And I want to go to Elise Gould, who's arguing for the motion. Your opponent's point is that the studies show us something that's not intuitively correct. And you're the economist, and you're the one who knows the studies, and it's difficult to get into dueling studies, but does he have a point that the majority, or the consensus, as he put it, of the studies show that the numbers just aren't there?
On the one hand, he's absolutely right that the research is not conclusive that mobility has declined. But I think that the argument that we've seen growing income inequality happen over the last generation, over the last 30 years, income inequality has gotten worse. When we want to really measure this, we're kind of at a loss, because we have to wait, we have to see what happens as those kids growing up in the most unequal times, what is going to happen with their outcomes, which is why I look at education, because that's what we can see today. We can look at those opportunities that lead to a realization of the American dream, and those opportunities are simply not there.
Scott Winship.
Well, you hear this a lot, I think, as a sort of retreating move. When folks acknowledge that mobility has not fallen, you do hear this argument about, well, you know, we'll see it in today's generation. But I will say that the study that was done by Emmanuel Saez with Raj Chetty, who's a Harvard economist that won the award for the smartest economist under 40 with 7 years to spare, they look at young adults. They look at people who are in their late 20s. They measured their parental incomes in the mid-1990s. At that point, they had experienced rising income concentration. The share of income received by the top 1% had been rising at that point for 15 years, and it didn't show up in their results.
And Nick Hauer, I mean, I don't want to dwell forever on these studies, but they are the evidence we have, and your partner has conceded that that there at least is not a consensus on this. What do we do with studies that are done by serious economists who are respected, peer-reviewed, who are telling us that they can't find evidence that your side of the motion is actually correct?
Just because the industrialized nations have not been radically unequal enough to allow economists to do timescale studies to prove that it will be harmful doesn't mean it's not. And in fact, if you look around the world, there are 205 countries running simultaneous experiments on how to create prosperous societies. And in every single case where you find radical inequality, you find low social economic mobility around the world, right? This is not a far out concept. You know, the truth is that the United States has only been a highly unequal society for 10 to 20 years. 30 years ago, it was not that bad. And so the fact that we haven't had the time to measure it doesn't tell you anything. But your common sense, on the other hand, should inform you highly.
Ed Conard.
Yeah, Nick is doing something that a lot of mobility scholars on the left try to do. They want to mix the results from high-wage economies with low-wage economies. Everybody serious in this field separates those apart. You have to look at them separately. And when you look at high-wage economies, you simply don't find what Nick's saying. The second thing I'd ask as well, when we think about going into the future, we do know this about the future. If we look backwards at the past, things have gotten more prosperous over time. The amount of money that we transfer in this economy has grown from about 11% to about 14% today.
Use the term, explain the term transfer.
It's money economic that we take from one group of people in the economy and give to the other.
Through what devices?
Taxation and government intervention.
Okay.
A lot of that goes to the elderly. But the CBOs look very carefully at the income that goes to the non-elderly families in the bottom 20%. 2006, when they did the study, it was $15,000. It doesn't include state transfers, which brings it up to closer to 20. It's grown with inflation since then. Today, it is very close to about $25,000. We are doing a lot to try to help people at the bottom of the scale and to increase their mobility. And as we go forward into the future, we're going to be doing even more and more. And what is driving that? The success of our economy is making that available.
Elise Gould, let's have you respond.
I mean, I think what we've seen, if we look, as you said, we should look at other advanced economies. And as I said in my opening remarks, we have lower mobility than Denmark, Norway, Finland, Sweden, Japan, Spain, France, a number of countries that are advanced economies. And I want to respond to one other thing that Ed said about transfers and resources. One thing you said in your opening comments, you mentioned helping the working poor. The idea of that we have working poor in this country is, I think it just leaves such a bad taste in my mouth that we have people that are hardworking, working full-time, maybe full year, and they can't lift their families out of poverty. We absolutely need to think about...
Let me stop you there and go to Ed, because the question was directed at you. And the last thing that Elise said goes to the point of our motion, that they can't lift themselves out of poverty. What's your response to that?
Well, I think there are many people who have a difficult time lifting themselves out of poverty. If you're sick, if you have mental illness, drug addiction, convicted of a crime, and you're an ex-convict, it's going to be difficult for you to lift yourself out of poverty. But there are many, many, many people who can lift themselves out of poverty. Tens of millions of Hispanic immigrants have come across the border. They were making $2-3 an hour. They're making $7 to $15 today, many of them, many more than that. And they have lifted themselves out of poverty. But I would like...
Mitt Romney loves the song America the Beautiful. You knew that, of course, but what you may not have known is that Mitt Romney is actually a very talented lyricist. I'm not concerned, I'm not concerned about the very poor. That's just the bitter politics of envy and class war. I'll tell you what, $10,000, $10,000 bet. No one has ever asked to see my birth certificate. I like being able to fire people who provide services to me. I'm running for office, for Pete's sake. I can't have illegals. I think it's fine to talk about those things in quiet rooms. This feels good being back in Michigan. The trees are the right height. Our corporations, people, well, of course they are my friends. I think of corporations as my friends with dividends. I pay 13-point-something%. My income is unearned. And poverty's a problem, but again, I'm not concerned. I have great friends who are NASCAR team owners. I got started right this morning with a biscuit and some cheesy grits. Even if you have a child 2 years of age, you need to go to work. I want the individuals to have the dignity of work. Take a shot, go for it. Borrow some money if you have to from your parents. America, America, God shed his grace on me. And Switzerland, the Caymans, and wherever it may be, that accounts can live tax-free. That's my foreign policy.
And now, back to the debate. Does income inequality impair the American dream?
No, I want to go back to, I just wanted to have you as, and Elise, I just want to come back to you with that question. All right, conceding that some people can't lift themselves out of poverty, what does that have to do with people being very rich at the top?
If we know that a larger share of the pie is going to the top, that means that there's less there for everybody else. When there's less there for everybody else, there's fewer resources going particularly to the bottom. There's fewer resources, and parents cannot afford to make those investments. And all of those things provide a situation where children just do not have the same opportunities to succeed.
Okay, Scott Winship, in your opening statement, I think I heard you also agree with your opponents while you're arguing against this motion. You agreed with them that there is a threat to opportunity. Did I hear you correctly in that?
You heard me correctly that I do agree that that we have upward mobility that is too limited in the United States. So the figures that I like to cite, if you're born in the bottom fifth, raised in the bottom fifth, you only have about a 30 to 40% chance of making it either to the middle class or better than that. That's far too low in my book. I'm as concerned as anybody about how do we increase upward mobility rates. But I just think if you're talking about bang for your buck, focusing on bringing the incomes at the top down is just not going to buy you much.
Okay, so you're saying the problems are real, but the cause is not the fact that people like Nick Hanauer are making a lot of money. Nick Hanauer, you think it is?
Yeah, No. I mean, look, I mean, you misunderstand our point. I do not for a moment believe that the problem with the economy is that we have too much success and we should hinder it in some way. We're in violent agreement about that. Mm-hmm. That our economy benefits massively from very clever and very hardworking people taking risks and innovating. That's not the question. The question is, should only a few percent of us be able to do that? And the answer to that is categorically no. I mean, here's the way to connect these two things. Why are the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer? Well, here's a reason, because over the last 40 years, the percent of profits that American corporations generate as a percentage of GDP has gone from 6 to 12%. At the same time, the percent of GDP devoted to labor has gone from 52 to 42. So that difference is about $1 trillion. Here's the thing you have to understand. That $1 trillion isn't profit because it needs to be or should be. It's profit because powerful people like me and Ed prefer it to be. That $1 trillion could very easily be spent on wages or on discounts for consumers. This isn't a consequence of some magical law of economics. This is a consequence of differentials in power.
I'm John Donvan, and you're listening to Intelligence Squared U.S., Oxford-style debating on American shores. Stay with us.
Okay, I want to remind you that we are in the question and answer section of this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate. I'm John Donvan, your moderator, and we have four debaters, two against two, debating this motion, income inequality impairs the American dream of upward mobility. Ed Conard.
Take, for example, test prep that we've talked about and how much parents are preparing. There are two kinds of colleges. There's prestigious colleges which have a limited number of slots, and then there's other colleges which basically have an unlimited number of slots. What's happened is that in the prestigious... In the prestigious colleges, we have allocated more and more slots to lower-income students and to minority students. And as a result, what you find is that rich white students are working harder and harder for a limited number of slots in the most prestigious schools. At the same time, at the less prestigious schools, anybody who's capable of going, who takes the test and is able to get through the school, can go to those schools. There is no shortage of slots. We've increased the number of slots. We've increased the number of students in participating in that. So it would be unfair, for example, to say, geez, there's more and more rich students going to those schools than there are poor schools, the poor students today. Any student who can get there can get there. And we have spent more and more money trying to help people get as far as they can in life. And we've tried to help those people at the bottom who are not able to pull themselves out of poverty. It's not as though we're letting those people starve to death. We are giving them a substantial amount of money to try to help them maintain some standard of living at that level.
I'm not so sure about there being infinite slots in all the other schools, but that's another question.
On what planet is that happening?
And test prep is really far more available to the higher income. So that's not really where I want to go either. I think the direction I want to go is inequality at the starting gate. And from that, I mean inequality at the beginning of kindergarten. These differences are found very early on. The differences in resources available to higher income children is far greater than available to lower income children. As I said before, higher rates of unemployment, instability, lower income, all of those things absolutely come at a cost to kids. And you see vast disparities, even the first day of kindergarten.
All right, I want to go to some questions and answers now from the audience. And if you can stand up too, thanks.
Hi, I'm Mike. So I was expecting to hear the against side arguing a lacking relationship between the two, between inequality and upward mobility. And instead, I kind of heard you guys suggesting that inequality can drive upward mobility. So I'm wondering if you would advocate active and systemic mechanisms to do just that, to increase inequality as a tough love mechanism to helping the poor.
Go, Ed, go.
That's about the best question we've had in about a year. Ed Conard.
I think that customers decide how much people get paid, how much they're willing to pay for products and for employees and such. And so anything that gets in the way of that slows growth. It doesn't increase growth. And so, no, I would be against any policy that tried to artificially do what customers don't want.
Elise Gould.
I don't think customers decide. I think we're talking about how we're splitting how much of the profits come in, and we've seen record high profits. I don't think customers decided that CEO to the average worker pay should go from 30 to 1 30 years ago to almost 300 to 1 today.
Another question.
Hi, what about the aspirational aspect of the spread, the inequality spread? In Freakonomics, Stephen Dubner talked about the drug dealers and how many people were in that trade because there was a chance that they might be able to get to the very top. And if the top is getting higher, is that becoming more aspirational and potentially improving mobility?
Does the top rung really give you something to shoot for? Okay, that's a really interesting question. Let's take it to Ed. Conard, would you like to take that or your partner?
Yes, I think that innovation is like any game of chance. The higher the payoff, the more risk people will take. And so what we have seen in our economy is that as we've raised the bar for success, our most capable people at the highest end or our highest earning people have worked harder and harder, more and more hours than the rest of the world. And they have taken more and more entrepreneurial risk and produced way more innovation than the rest of the world has. And ultimately, that's translated into a much higher growth rate. And so we do keep raising the bar. And it's not really the bar for money. That's not what motivates people. It's the status that goes along with it. And as the bar gets raised, you have to achieve more and more to get to the same level of status. And that drives our most talented people to work harder and harder and take more risks. And that is what everybody else needs from the most talented people. We need those people working hard.
Nick Hanauer.
So quick audience poll with your hands, not the buttons. Who thinks they work harder than their parents?
You need to tell the radio audience what you're seeing.
Two-thirds of the room.
Do you think you work harder than your parents because your tax rates are lower than theirs? I don't think so. So hard work is an extremely important thing, but it is completely uncorrelated to the tax rates we pay. That's the first point. And the second thing is, and this is the most difficult thing to talk about when we talk about upward mobility and the American dream and inequality, and that is this, that humans are status-seeking creatures. We are not optimizing for money. We are optimizing for social position. And when you go from a world where to fly first class is to be affluent, wealthy, to a world where you have to have a $25 million Falcon 2000 to be affluent, to live large, you have stretched the society apart in a way that means that 99.999% of the people in the society cannot live the good life.
And Nick, you don't think, John, that people will aspire to that? You think they'll be turned off by it?
I don't think that they will aspire one iota more in the second scenario than the first. It's just that in the second scenario, 99.999% of you fail. And I would argue that having a society that is an arms race, that is structured to be an arms race, that no one except me and maybe a couple of other people in the audience can possibly win, is a winning solution to building a good society.
I would also say this. Ask the 50 million adult immigrants and their children whether or not they benefited from this arms race or they were hurt by this arms race. He talks like a rich man, okay? A poor guy benefits from the fact that we are working our tails off and taking the entrepreneurial risks that grow the economy and increase prosperity. Rich guys walk around and say, wouldn't it be wonderful if we didn't have an arms race and I didn't have to have my, whatever it was, Falcon something, in order to be successful? We need you to be working your tail off. It's the poor people that need you to be working your tail off.
The poor people are working their tails off.
I didn't say they weren't. But in Europe and Japan, they have not been able to produce the innovation and the growth and the employment that the U.S. economy has. It is 2 to 3 times faster. It is an extraordinary difference.
And that concludes round two of this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate.
Ladies and gentlemen, we now take you behind the scenes to the Middle East peace negotiations, where the U.N. negotiator has just introduced Yasser Arafat to Benjamin Netanyahu. The negotiator was overheard to say, "Yasser, that's my Bibi." Here comes Mr. Netanyahu now.
I just met with Mr. Arafat. We met man to man, eye to eye, knee to groin. And I said, "We have a no deal, have a no deal, have a no deal, Israel will save. Hamas, Mubarak, Hamas, Mubarak, Hamas, Mubarak, Arafat, go shave. Assad, don't run around, Assad, don't run around, Assad, don't run around, we are after peace. Saddam, Iraqi Scud, Saddam, Iraqi Scud, Saddam, Iraqi Scud, your head we will crease. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Neptun.
Netanyahu.
I'm Netanyahu.
Yahoo.
Come on, you know who.
Who are you?
My name is Bibi.
You give me the heebie-jeebie.
Yahoo. Yahoo.
Could be Bibi.
Yahoo.
And now for something completely different.